Well, we are very fortunate now to be joined by none other than Zafar Bengash. Zafar, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Phil. It's my great pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, we're going to give you some heavy work to do today. There's been an election, and it isn't quite done in Turkey.
Right.
But more closely to close to home for you, because you have been informing us, Pakistan is going through a really turbulent situation. I'll set the stage from my vantage point. I read that the former prime minister had gone to attend court to, I suppose, make a plea in a case, and then found himself arrested. And I said to myself, in Pakistan, this kind of situation doesn't usually end with you, the individual, still alive. But he has now walked out of that situation, I gather, due to popular resistance, perhaps not. I'll leave it in your hands, but what is going on now?
Yes, well, basically, as you mentioned, the former Prime Minister, Imran Khan, had gone to the Islamabad High Court to make an appearance in a case, which was basically a very, nonsensical case against him. There are actually about 150 cases registered against him in different parts of the country, all of them totally bogus, totally false. But in any case, he had gone to the court to appear before the judge to say, well, I've come here, I have accepted that I'm supposed to appear in court, and the judge would have given him another date to appear there.
Yes.
Instead, as he was giving his fingerprints inside the court premises, that's a requirement in order for him to identify himself, etc., etc. This was the biometric room. So the paramilitary forces of Pakistan, referred to as Rangers, they broke the glass of that room, and they actually kidnapped him. They didn't arrest him. They kidnapped him, because in order to arrest a person, there has to be an arrest warrant. There has to be a charge. There was no such thing. So these commandos, under the control or command of the army, the Pakistan army, they hit him on his head. He was injured. They hit him on his injured leg where he had bullets. They grabbed him by the collar of his shirt and dragged him and put him in a van and took him away. And there was, of course, his bodyguards were also beaten up. His defense lawyers were beaten up inside the court premises. He had not appeared in court yet. He was just sort of going through the preliminary requirements.
Mm-hmm.
And he just simply disappeared. And of course, his lawyers went to court. The judge said, of course, the judge was also involved in this conspiracy because he had been taking instructions from the military as to what to do. Initially, he said, I'm furious at what has happened. This is unprecedented. He cannot be arrested from court premises, etc. And then after several hours of delays, he came back and he said, well, his arrest was legal. That's what the judge said. And he knew that this is illegal. There is no arrest warrant for him. There are no charges against him. Mm. It's simply an allegation. And this, what was the allegation? Let me explain that as well. The government alleged that Imran Khan had, there is a real estate tycoon, an absolute criminal. His name is Malik Riaz. And this man has most of the generals in his pocket, because he builds palatial homes for
generals
them.
Generals aren't that expensive these days.
Exactly. And he hands them over the keys and says, General, here it is, enjoy your beautiful house, your luxury house, without, obviously, for free. And this man was charged with embezzlement of billions of dollars in funds. So he struck a deal with, there is an organization in Pakistan called National Accountability Bureau. The abbreviation is NAB. It was sort of, you know, they have this dark humor, you see. And so he made a, he struck a deal with NAB, and he said, okay, I'm prepared to pay a certain amount of money to the government of Pakistan, and I should be, you know, drop the, all the other charges. So NAB accepted that deal from him. And this was in 2008 when Imran Khan's government was about to come into power. He became the prime minister in August of 2018. And so he paid the British equivalent of 190 million pounds sterling, because the money was basically, you know, he had taken it to England. So that money came to Pakistan. And it was then decided in a cabinet meeting that this money should be used to build a university in a place where there was no university. It's called Al Khair University. And Imran Khan and his wife are the trustees of a trust called Al Qadir Trust. And that trust is basically managing this university. So this man, this crook, you know, Malik Riaz, gave about 458, not acres, but like, you know, half of that land to the university, and also paid that money. So Imran Khan, his government, through a cabinet approval, put that money to build that university where students are now enrolled. And this was the charge made by these crooks who are in power today to say, well, Imran Khan embezzled these funds. He didn't embezzle these funds. Unlike these crooks who have taken billions of dollars out of the country, they have bought palatial homes, and when, you know, these same mad people ask them, could you please give us any proof of how you managed to buy these properties in the most expensive areas of London or Paris or Switzerland or these massive islands that you have bought in Australia, could you please tell us? They can't give any proof of that, and yet they are accusing Imran Khan of doing this so-called illegal thing. So he was taken into, you know, kidnapped by the Rangers. First, this illegitimate government that is in power in Pakistan, they said, well, he's in NAB control because they are the ones who are, you know, who have arrested him. Later on, it transpired that, you know, when the people of NAB were contacted, they said, no, he's not in our custody. The police have taken him. When the police were contacted, they said, no, he's not in our custody. So it was the intelligence agency that had then taken Imran Khan and kept him in a horrible condition. They took him and they locked him up in a single room. They took his cell phone away from him. They didn't give him a bed or a mattress or a pillow. They didn't give him food for 24 hours. They didn't give him water for 24 hours. They wouldn't even let him go to the washroom for 24 hours. And then finally, after, you know, a day and a half, when he appeared in court again, because his lawyers had lodged an appeal in the Supreme Court of Pakistan to say that he was arrested illegally, that is when the Supreme Court ruled that his arrest was illegal, that he should not have been arrested because there was no warrant for his arrest. There was no reason for his arrest.
They had to get a warrant.
Yes, exactly. So you can see that. I mean, right from top to bottom, there is illegality going on. And of course, you know, when Imran Khan was arrested, he and his, you know, supporters had always said that his arrest would be a red line. And if you arrest him, then there are no holds barred. Then we are going to, you know, make sure that somebody pays a price. So obviously, there were massive demonstrations throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And of course, there were a number of untoward incidents also happened. For instance, the masses attacked the military headquarters in Rawalpindi. They also attacked the house of the corps commander in Lahore, the top general in Lahore, etc. There were a number of other incidents, but in the process, something like 50 to 70 people have been shot dead. Hundreds, perhaps, you know, the information is as high as 5,000 members of Imran Khan's party have been arrested, as well as all of the top leadership of his party have been arrested.
Now, I have to ask you there. Now, they realize that they're in a real jackpot, I suppose. So he's released. How about those, his party members? Are any of them being released?
No, all of them.
This is not a good picture.
Nobody knows where they are being held. In fact, you know, they were arrested in broad daylight. And the accusation against them was that they had committed treason because they had instigated these quote-unquote rioters to do all of these things. In fact, there is an even more sinister plan was underway, and that was that the army chief, his name is General Asif Munir, and many people, many commentators say that the general is he's been appointed army chief illegally because his army service should have ended on November 27, 2022. And the army chief's appointment was made on November 29, 2022. So that means that General Asif Munir's time in the army had already expired, and he should have retired on November 27, 2022. But through a sleight of hand, he was then appointed the army chief on November 29.
Is this the gentleman we began to see when they first removed Imran Khan? They began to have interviews with an individual. That was him?
No, that was his predecessor. He was also involved in this conspiracy. Because his predecessor...
So now we have the man who was in the shadows.
That's correct, yes. So this man, obviously, they're all, the army generals are all, you know, linked with each other. And they try to sort of, you know, make sure that they get their own favorites in these positions, influential positions. Because regrettably, these generals have become so thoroughly corrupt. They are... Almost all of them are billionaires. They're all of their family members and children, etc., have either American citizenship or British citizenship or even Canadian citizenship or Australian citizenship. They've got millions of dollars worth of properties abroad. They're not army personnel. They are basically business tycoons now. They are real estate agents now. And that's all that they do. But I wanted to share with you this information about the Lahore Corps commander, who actually happens to be a decent person. His name is General, he's basically General Salman Ghani. Now, Salman Ghani, the army chief, General Asim Munir, ordered him to get his troops to shoot at the demonstrations or the people that were protecting Imran Khan at his house in Lahore. So this general turned around to the army chief and he said, this is an illegal order. I will not ask my troops to fire on civilians. This is a policing matter. The police should handle it. My troops would not do it. So then this army chief basically plotted to have this general in Lahore killed, this General Salman Ghani. And the reason and the way how he planned it was that there is a road that leads to this general's house. There is a 2-mile stretch, 2 miles away from his house. Nobody is allowed to come inside or on that road towards the general's house. There are a number of police and military checkpoints, as well as a force called the Quick Response Force. And this force is made up of commanders. In case there is an emergency, these people are immediately mobilized to go to take action to protect their army personnel. So on that particular day, on May 9th, on this 2-mile stretch, there was no... All the army personnel, all the police personnel, the quick response force, etc., all had disappeared. There was absolutely nobody to provide security. So this mob comes, walks 2 miles towards this general's house. They actually enter the general's house because there is no security over there. And he's stunned. He says, how could these people arrive over here? And he then tries to contact a number of generals that work under him. The general officer commanding of 10th Division, 11th Division, Director General of Rangers, nobody answers the phone. Nobody. They don't want to answer the phone. And so this mob enters his house, and now there is evidence available that this mob that had come to attack his house, these were not necessarily supporters of Imran Khan. These were agent provocateurs who were basically army personnel mobilized by the army chief. They were in plain clothes. There is video now available. that they had been dropped off some distance away from there. These people were in a military vehicle. They were in plain clothes. They were armed with sticks and all kinds of other things. And they moved in there, and they basically wanted to kill this general. And the army chief wanted to use that as a pretext to say, well, look, Imran Khan's supporters have killed a serving general, so we now need to arrest Imran Khan, charge him with murder, and send him to the gallows or put him away forever and ban his political party because they are terrorists, they are indulging in this kind of behavior. Can you imagine the country's armed forces chief is involved in these kinds of conspiracies?
And there it's unimaginable, but if I could consult CSIS, it's thinkable.
Unbelievable, you know. Can you imagine, like, there are also a number of other generals who refuse to obey the army chief's orders to shoot on civilians. There are now, according to the information that is available from very reliable sources, that more than 150 to 200 young officers, these are captains and majors who are basically on the front line on these duties, who refuse to obey the orders to shoot at civilians. So they've been arrested. They're going to be court-martialed. So look at the situation that an army chief is now court-martialing his own officers because they refuse to carry out illegal orders. So this is the kind of situation that we are faced with in Pakistan today. So in order to sum it up, basically, there are now two forces in Pakistan. One is the army chief and a small group of generals around him who want to crush all dissent in the country, who do not allow a political process to take place. And on the other hand, you have Imran Khan and his political party, which is so popular. According to recent polls, I mean, his party's popularity and Imran Khan's popularity has touched 90%. And if there were elections, and that's what Imran Khan is insisting on, that there should be immediate elections in the country because these bunch of criminals that the army has installed.
Yes, they created a political crisis when they interfered with the democratic process, right?
Exactly.
And the only answer would be to turn it over to the people and vote again.
Exactly. Now, there is also another aspect to this, and that is that Imran Khan's party was in power in two major provinces, which is the Punjab province, the biggest province in the country, with 60% of the population, and the KPK, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is on the border with Afghanistan. His party was in power in both provinces, and he told his party members to resign en masse, surrendered their resignations to the governors of the two provinces. So according to the constitution, elections in these provinces should be held within 90 days after the assemblies have been dissolved. And it's been more than 90 days since these assemblies were dissolved. Imran Khan's party went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ordered that elections should be held within 90 days. And yesterday was the deadline for holding elections in these two provinces, according to the Supreme Court order. Yet, of course, no elections were held. Instead, what happened was that an allied party of the ruling group of criminals. This is a vile party. It's a religious party, but led by a vile man who's extremely, obnoxious, who's, who calls himself a religious leader, but he's a complete thug who has these gangsters in his party. They came to Islamabad to surround the Supreme Court building where the court hearing was taking place because Imran Khan's party had now appealed to the Supreme Court and said that these people are in violation of the Supreme Court order for not holding elections. And so the current government in power should be held in contempt of court and whatever, punishment the court wants to give that they should do. So what they do, they bring these gangsters over there armed with clubs and all kinds of other things, and they attack the Supreme Court. They climb over the gates and want to terrorize the Chief Justice and his other justices. Of course,
it doesn't. Sounds like a meltdown. Actually, it kind of reminds me of the situation with the Shah. But go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes, absolutely. Like that's the situation. Like everybody in Pakistan realizes that the Supreme Court is the last institution that can bring any semblance of normalcy to this madness that has gripped the country. But unfortunately, these generals in that are basically the real power wielders in Pakistan, and these gangsters and murderers and rapists that they have put in power in Pakistan don't want to hold elections, because they know that if elections were held, Imran Khan's party would sweep the polls. There is no doubt in anybody's mind. And so what they are doing is they are trying to create a scenario in which they will either kill Imran Khan, or if they cannot do that, I mean, they've had at least two attempts on his life, and he has miraculously survived on both occasions.
Mm-hmm.
Or they want to put him away in prison for life so that he would be out of the picture, and they want to ban his party because, you know, they know that if his party is allowed to contest elections, it will win whether Imran Khan is in or out of jail. And since Imran Khan has vowed that once he comes back to power, he's going to go after all of these criminals, whether politicians or army generals, the plunder that they have carried out, the crimes that
they have carried out. So for them, they're beginning to see it as life or death for them.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is.
I want to ask you, by the way, and this is Zafar Benyesh, and you're lucky to be listening to CIUT Taylor Report, because Zafar is an authority on these matters and been rather close to all these things. Some of these individuals you have yourself met, Zafar.
Yes.
I want to ask you, I'm hearing that he is calling, Imran Khan is calling for, what are they calling it, freedom demonstrations or something? Is this what do you think, is this tactic going to be? What is involved in that?
Yes. Well, he has actually on several occasions called for demonstrations. For instance, he called for a demonstration 3 days ago to express solidarity with the justices of the Supreme Court, because he knows that these gangsters are threatening the judges of the Supreme Court. Mm. And even today, he called for a demonstration in support of the judges, because these gangsters are all assembled.
Oh, that's really interesting. That's
exactly
interesting.
Outside the Supreme Court, and they are basically trying to terrorize the judges. Now, it's also interesting to note that since May the 9th, when Imran Khan was arrested, this illegitimate regime immediately imposed what is referred to as Section 144. We had talked about this before. Section 144 is a colonial era law which prohibits the gathering of more than 4 persons. Now, this law is applied to Imran Khan's party, but now that they have brought their own thugs and goons right in front of the Supreme Court, and in an area that is referred to as the red zone, that is a very secure security area where, you know, cars are not allowed to come in, people are not allowed to come in without purpose, without any sort of legitimate reason. These thugs have been brought in. Nobody is objecting to it. They have brought these big clubs, and I'm sure they are also carrying guns, etc. And they've been allowed to assemble in large numbers, and they have even attacked the Supreme Court. And yet, you know, Imran Khan's party members are arrested by the thousands because they are accused of violating Section 144 by gathering in large numbers. So you see the kind of ridiculous situation that the people of Pakistan face at the present time.
Now, I'm also reading, and the New York Times, I think, said it, and journals in Pakistan, India, talking about this, and they say that the Pakistan population is becoming rabidly anti-American in this thing. Why, if that's true?
You see, the simple reason is that the people of Pakistan have realized that the problems that Pakistan faces today is the direct result of America's gross interference in Pakistan's internal affairs through the military. And the people of Pakistan understand that whatever the military is doing today is in order to appease America. Now, you can see from the way the White House spokesperson, the State Department spokesperson, including our foreign minister, she was asked in Parliament about the situation in Pakistan by one of the Pakistani origin MPs who belongs to the Liberal Party, Samir Zubair. He's from Quebec. He said that, you know, I've received thousands of letters or, you know, calls from constituents and people of Pakistani origin, Canadians of Pakistani origin, who are deeply concerned about what's happening in Pakistan. What's the Canadian government's position? And she gave this wishy-washy answer. She said, we are monitoring the situation, we are very concerned, and we are in touch, and so on. This is a pet statement that was issued by the Prime Minister of Britain. This is the same statement issued by the State Department spokesperson, the same statement issued by the White House spokesperson. We are monitoring the situation. We are, you know, closely monitoring.
So now we know what the Anglo-Saxons think.
Exactly. So now, exactly. And now, you know, one of the Pakistani journalists made a very good observation. He said, if, let's say, something similar was happening in Iran or Syria or China,
oh boy,
the Americans or everybody else would be pouncing on them.
Sanctions, sanctions.
Exactly.
Starve them.
And here they are sort of taking refuge behind this thing, you know, it's an internal matter for Pakistan, we don't want to interfere in it, etc. But for God's sake, the same thing applies to Iran, the same thing applies to Syria, the same thing applies to China, the same thing applies to Russia. So how come you interfere in their affairs? You have
yes,
no qualms.
Happily.
And yet, in case
yeah.
of Pakistan, you sit back and say, well, you know, we are monitoring the situation and you don't want to interfere.
Are you optimistic about this situation? I mean, Imran Khan has in Parliament, he has the most members, doesn't he? I know that they've knocked him out, but he does actually have a powerful political base. They can't make it go away with a magic wand. How do you picture this unfolding?
No, you see, all of his members resigned from Parliament back in 2022 when the army chief at that time engineered a coup against him by bribing a number of Parliament members that were not members of Imran Khan's party, but that were allied to his party to give him a majority in Parliament. So the general basically bribed those parliamentarians, about 20, 25 of them, took them away from Imran Khan, and so he no longer had a majority in Parliament. And so what he and his party members did was that they resigned en masse from the Parliament. And he said, now this Parliament is a minority Parliament. It has no legitimacy, so there should be fresh elections. And
yes.
that is the struggle that he's waging all the time.
So the goal is to force an election, popular
exactly.
election. From his point of view, that's what he wants.
Exactly. And that's what the Constitution also calls for. And yet, and the Supreme Court has ruled that that should be the case. And yet, the army is backing these gangsters, and they are delaying elections because what they are aiming to do is to see if they can either convict Imran Khan on murder charges or treason charges.
Mm.
The aim is to actually get him out of politics altogether.
How can he, by the way, how does he get the word out? Does he have any media support or is everything under the control of the army? Can you turn on your television in Pakistan and see him? What's the situation?
As far as the main channels are concerned, unfortunately, each and every one of those channels, and there are 35 of them in Pakistan, they're all controlled by the intelligence agency in Pakistan. So on the official channels, there is absolutely nothing. In fact, the internet is shut down in Pakistan. Facebook is shut down. Twitter is shut down. YouTube is shut down. But there is something else called VPN. It's an alternate sort of, you know, media platform. And Imran Khan is able to get his message out through this source. And a lot of people are able, and they just circulate it like wildfire. Because he has got literally millions of followers in the country, millions of followers outside Pakistan. And of course, you know, there are Western channels like Sky News in Britain, BBC and others, they continuously interview him because they see this as a story that they would like to report on. So his message is getting across to the people. And so despite the best efforts of the military, its intelligence agencies, and these criminals that are in power, they are not able to shut off Imran Khan's voice. Like, you know, 2 days ago, he gave a long speech from his house, and within minutes, there were literally tens of thousands of people that had viewed his speech, within minutes. And he has millions of followers all around the country as well as around the world.
I have to ask you also, just because you make me worry for him, if we all should be, but he must have an entourage of capable people.
He does. In fact, there are people that are willing to die for him. And that's
Like gifted politicians, right? People who could become the voice. Because, as you know, the hanging generals in history figure they get rid of one guy and their problems are over.
Yes.
But this doesn't look like that kind of situation. But does he, within that party that he built, are they capable individuals?
Oh, yes, absolutely. He has a lot of very capable and very smart individuals. And some of them are, in fact, quite young and still very articulate. So what he has done is that he has developed a very broad-based party. And unfortunately, the vast majority of them, those leaders have also been arrested. So in fact, the top leadership, the second-tier leadership, the third-tier leadership, and thousands of his party workers have been arrested.
Whoa.
But naturally, they can't kill all of them. In fact, I'll give you the example of one young man. His name is Murad Saeed. He belongs to the same province where I was born, the KPK. There is, in fact, he actually released a video, and he said that I'm releasing this message to everybody that the army has issued orders for me to be shot on sight. And so I'm issuing this message to you. Perhaps I may not be able to speak to you again, but I want you to know that this is what the army has done. And so he has gone into hiding. He's not been arrested. But as I mentioned, hundreds of other leaders of Imran Khan's party have been arrested. That includes women as well. I mean, he's got a number of very highly capable women members in his party. You know, they are extremely highly educated, very articulate, extremely capable. In fact, there is one lady, her name is Dr. Sania Nishtar. She was in charge of what was, during Imran Khan's time, what was referred to as the Ihsas program, which basically meant a program of consciousness which helped poor people. And this was such a brilliant program. She basically provided 10 million health cards to poor people so that they could get free medical services and medicine. She provided established shelters for homeless people. She established feeding centers for millions of people. Her program was so successful that Stanford University actually did a study on it, and they said that this is the most brilliant social upliftment program that they have seen in decades. Now, you can see that, you know, Imran Khan has attracted people of that caliber.
I hope you're not going to tell me she's under arrest.
Well, I don't know if she is under arrest, but they are going after everybody. In fact, there's another lady, her name is Dr. Yasmin Rashid. She was the health minister in Imran Khan's party. She's an elderly lady. She has also been arrested because, you know, she is also a very good organizer. And despite the fact that, you know, on May the 9th, when there were protests taking place, she came out among the protesters, sitting on top of a vehicle and urging people not to be violent. They said, do not go to the, you know, general's home. We want to stay outside. We want to stay peaceful. And yet she was arrested. Now she's in hospital on a respirator because she's a very elderly lady. She's not in good health. And these are the kinds of things that they're doing in Pakistan today. And all because these damn generals want to be in the good books of the Americans, and they want to continue to plunder the country and continue to enjoy their privileges. They are acting as parasites, quite honestly.
I guess the last question on that subject, because I got to ask you about Erdogan, but is aren't they bright enough to offer something? Don't they try to back channel, have a conversation? Are they just determined to hang on with an iron fist?
Well, that's what they think. They think that, you know, basically there are just a few generals, and they are terrified. They are terrified because they know that if they were to allow Imran Khan to have elections, he will come to power, and then, you know, Imran Khan would
They'd
come
lose
up.
Their Australian citizenship.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, there have been back channels. For instance, the president, who's supposed to be above the political fray, he has had several meetings with Imran Khan to work out something. And Imran Khan said that, look, you know, when I come back into power, I'm not going to go on a personal vendetta, but please don't ask me to spare people that have indulged in fraud and murders and kidnappings, etc.
Good.
That would be against the law and against the Constitution.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. This is Zafar Bengash, and you're listening to CIUT and the Taylor Report, and we're very fortunate to have Zafar, and therefore we must, our duty says, have to ask you. Erdogan has been through a vote. He got, 49%, his opponent 44%, and he seems to have all the shadow powers of the West on tenterhooks. They seem to want him to go. I noticed his opponent in the last, and I'm going to start you off with Sharmeen Narwani. In the last week, his opponent suddenly started talking about how he was going to be tough on Russia. But, and before I came to the station, Sharmeen Narwani says today, they shouldn't take that one to the bank, because the opponent also says he would like the Belt and Road to come to Turkey.
Yes.
The Americans got all excited when they found out that the opponent said he didn't like, he might be nasty to the Russians. Which seems to be their main concern about the election. Anyway, I better leave it to you. What does this look like to you? Is it going to be a runoff?
Yes, of course, because Erdogan did not achieve the 50.1% vote that would have got him in yesterday in the first round. And his opponent, as you mentioned, got 44%. So there is going to be a second round in 2 weeks' time. Now, the third presidential candidate, got about 5% of the vote, but he is a Turkish nationalist, and he's more inclined towards Erdogan. So it would seem...
Oh, so he'll be stepping out, and that 5% will come into play.
Well, exactly. And so it is more than likely that even if, let's say, 1% of that vote were to go to Erdogan, Erdogan would be in power then. And this is what looks like at the present time. You know, I was, scanning the media, and it was so interesting. Day before yesterday, the Economist of London, they said that we want to see the back of Erdogan. He has created a lot of mess, and, you know, we want his opponent to win, etc. The New York Times, Washington Post, all of them are after Erdogan because they don't want him to be around.
They're impatient. They've had enough.
Exactly. And they were even predicting...
He's a poor servant.
Exactly. They were even predicting, his opponent's victory. They said, it looks like, you know, his opponent is going to win in the first round. And previously, they were constantly saying that, you know, all the vote is rigged in Turkey. There is no fair election, etc. But now when it became there was some chance that his opponent might win, that they all of a sudden said, well, he's going to win, and so Erdogan will be out, and we'll have somebody who is, West-friendly, and he's not so paranoid, and he's not, you know, friendly with our enemies, etc., etc. So, you know, unfortunately, that's the situation that we find ourselves in as far as Turkey is concerned.
Well, go ahead.
Yeah, but my reading is that in the second round, I think probably Erdogan would be able to get in, perhaps by, 52-53% of the vote. And so that would
be roughly what he got before.
That's correct, yes.
And incidentally, my understanding is that they haven't counted the diaspora vote, but historically, he gets a large portion of the diaspora vote.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, yes, the diaspora is able is generally much more sympathetic to him. But the problem is that the diaspora vote is altogether only 0.5% of the total vote. So 0.5% may just get him in, because the last time he got 60% of the diaspora vote. And so if it's such a small percentage, you know, that doesn't really, that won't make a major difference.
Yeah.
One of the incredible things is that the voter turnout was 82.7%.
Yes. I'm so glad you point that out, because we pay, in Canadian Parliament, and Americans patronize him, and it's an autocracy. They don't have democracy. And a huge turnout. We're not talking about a huge vote for the winner. We're talking about a huge turnout of people voting.
Correct.
And they have dozens and dozens of political parties. They have a communist party. They have an Islamic party. They have feminist parties.
Yeah.
And we patronize them and talk about, cluck, cluck. They don't really have it. And even the Globe and Mail has a peculiar subhead. It says their doyen remains popular with rural, working class, and religious voters. I wish they'd use these words when they talk about Canada. It would be very interesting. But they, of course, we're talking about foreigners. We can do that.
Yeah, as far as the Globe is concerned, the rural working class people don't matter.
We certainly don't talk about them, because they just call them that, and they want to say, "Why'd you call me that?" And then they say, "Well, that's who you are."
We should disqualify all of the people in Canada that live in the rural areas. So that would wipe out the Atlantic provinces.
They're Doyen supporters.
Exactly. Northern Ontario and, you know, rural areas of Quebec and Manitoba and everybody. So I think all the provinces west of Ontario.
I think you'd see a few people in the streets.
Yeah.
But they also have a 600-member parliament, and they voted for them too.
Yes.
They're voting for the parliament. And my understanding, he has the largest party. I don't think he has more than 50% in parliament, but he has the largest, way in much more the largest party. Is that right?
Basically, what it is that in Turkey, since 2018, there have been a number of alliances among political parties. So Erdogan's party has four other parties aligned with his party, although his party is the largest. They form these coalition parties. And then the opposition also has about six parties together. And then there is a third coalition that has three parties together. So altogether, you have these various coalitions that are contesting the parliamentary seats. Mm-hmm. And so the way to do it is that, whichever coalition gets the largest number of votes, then they split up these votes between different parties. So even though Erdogan's party would still get the largest share of seats in parliament, but he may not necessarily have an absolute majority on its own. So his coalition partners also join him, all the other four coalition partners, and that would give them a comfortable majority in parliament.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's really important, because we have to talk about the region. Here we have really a dramatic new architecture in the areas there, because of China's involvement with Iran and Saudi Arabia. They got the two to agree to resume diplomatic work and also to call off tension and problems between them. And Mr. Erdogan sits at, like Iran, at the crossroads. And I get the impression he's part of this new situation. And so I want to ask you, if he comes back in and to power, can we assume then the progress with Syria will go forward? Because as I look at it, I've been worried that this election could really scramble the region again, depending on how it went. But anyway, what about that?
Yes, if he were to come back to power, I mean, even before this election, he was trying very hard to patch up his differences with Syria. Of course, the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, is insisting that...
Yeah, they've been holding out, right, saying, look, you have your election, and also, you guys have to... You and the Americans have to go home.
Exactly. That's what... That's the condition that he had imposed. He said that, you know, your troops must pull out before Bashar al-Assad would agree to Erdogan. But the Russians are actually making a serious effort. And, you know, last week, the Russian, Turkish, Iranian, and Syrian foreign ministers had got together in Moscow, and this was aimed at bringing about some kind of a resolution to this crisis or the imposed war on Syria. It's also important to keep in mind that all of the Arab governments have now made up with Syria. In fact, on May the 7th, there was a meeting of the Arab League in Cairo at which it was agreed that Syria would be readmitted to the Arab League, from which it was expelled in 2011. Mm-hmm. And on May the 19th, there is going to be a meeting in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. The Saudis have also established diplomatic relations with Syria. They are going to reopen their embassies. And this is all basically as a consequence of this rapprochement between Iran and Saudi Arabia that has been facilitated by China. Mm-hmm. And China is naturally moving in a big way in the region. And as you mentioned, the Belt and Road Initiative that China has launched.
Seems to intrigue people in the region.
Yes, China and obviously Iran is a major component of it. So is Turkey. There are going to be road and rail links. There is what is referred to as the international north, north-south transit route, etc. That will go from China all the way through Iran and Turkey into Europe, all the way up to Western Europe. That's a 7,200-kilometer road and rail and sea links. So there's a major, major component of that factor. So Turkey is within that plan.
Would you expect that Erdogan will visit Damascus if after he's elected?
I think, first of all, he has to make that that decision to withdraw Turkish forces.
He has to do the right thing, yes.
Yeah, I think it is more likely that this meeting might take place between them in Moscow rather than in Damascus. I think that is how it is likely to play out. Or the other alternative...
Or Beijing.
Exactly, or even Tehran, because Iran is also very anxious to get this thing resolved.
Or I suppose Saudi Arabia.
Or that could be as well.
Wouldn't that be a sight? I would love to see that. I confess, I'm being a non-journalist. I would like that.
I think the most likely venue is going to be Moscow, because there has been a lot of effort put by Russia to have this issue resolved. I think that's likely to be the most, possible venue. But you never know. As you said, it could be Beijing, it could be Tehran, it could be Saudi Arabia. Anything is possible. But I think the
new chapters, new book.
Yes.
Zafar, it's been great talking to you. You're a brilliant individual, and my listeners are very appreciative. And we look forward to talking to you after the elections.
Of course. My great pleasure, Phil. I always appreciate the opportunity to be able to share my thoughts with you. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay. Bye-bye. This is Taylor Report. It is CIUT, and we made Zafar do all the heavy lifting, and he did it quite well. By the way, a show you want to be listening to coming up. It is Tracks from Abroad. This is CIUT. See you next week.